Extraordinary careers, extraordinary stories, and for the first time, they're ready to tell them. These are the Narco Warriors. Coming up, the kidnapping deep inside hostile territory.
These caves were heavily fortified. There were at least 50 guys guarding it, and they had heavy weapons.
The British government calls in the cavalry.
If you're a Brit or any national kidnapped in the UK, we will throw the kitchen sink at identifying the stronghold where you are and help secure your safe release.
Then, staying alive and fighting the narcotics trade in West Africa, where drug mules take deadly risks.
One guy was arrested with 3.2 kilos that he'd ingested.
Also ahead, tracking violent gangs determined to stay invisible.
They didn't drive around in a big luxury limo. It wasn't like The Sopranos.
And our insiders weigh in on one of the most controversial debates in law enforcement, the decriminalisation of cannabis.
I've seen people who are habitual users of cannabis and they're fucked up.
These are the Narco Warriors. Now, Phil, things can go badly wrong in the field, and I think there was one occasion where a drug liaison officer was actually kidnapped by an Afghan warlord. This is a story that hasn't been told before.
Well, I came back from my posting in Thailand in spring of 93, and I was going to take over the management of the Western Hemisphere drug liaison officers, North America, Central America, Caribbean, South America. And I was on the handover with my predecessor when we had a serious incident. Our liaison officer in Karachi, the German BKA liaison officer in Karachi, and the Netherlands National Police officer in Karachi had travelled down to the Shaman border crossing, which is in Balochistan in Pakistan, quite a rural area on the border of Afghanistan. And they'd been invited over to an arms fair. The invitation had come from someone very senior, and they were told they would be well protected and looked after. The reality was that seven of them went over, and about 6 miles from the Shaman border crossing in a place called Spin Boldak, they were kidnapped by Mujahideen guerrillas. If I remember the name of the guerrilla commander, he was Abdullah Nourzai.
One of your DLOs was in that group.
Yeah, Jack, one of our DLOs was in that three. The three of them were captured and they were taken off to some caves where they had a very, very unpleasant couple of weeks. They were chained. They were not fed very well. The water they were given was really poor. And obviously they suffered a lot. The guys threatened them and it was a really bad incident for all three of them. As soon as they were kidnapped, UK Limited switched into gear and we did all the things that we would do if a British national was kidnapped overseas. I was sent to the Silver Command post in The Hague where with my colleagues from the Netherlands and Germany.
Can you just say what a Silver Command post is?
Well, a Silver Command is that the sort of people who support the top team who are actually leading the efforts to obtain the safe release of these people. We were doing some operational sharing of intelligence between the three countries and making sure that we were ready to receive any information from anybody and pass it to the powers that be.
Did you know where these three were?
We got feedback very quickly from the Afghan authorities who told us that they'd arrested these people for being in Afghanistan illegally, but in fact they'd been kidnapped. It was quite clear they were being kidnapped. High Commissioner, who I think was Sir Nicholas Barrington at the time, led the high-level negotiations locally. He had very good relationships both in Pakistan and with the Afghan Mujahideen, and it was very much a collaborative effort. The British Foreign Office Minister in London at the time, his name was Lennox Boyd. He also did a fantastic job in putting a tremendous amount of diplomatic pressure on Pakistan and Afghanistan to secure the safe release of our colleagues. We sent food parcels via third parties to the three guys to try and give them some support. And at that stage, of course, we were looking at all our options. So I would imagine that stage we were looking at whether we would have to try and extract these people. So our special forces would have been involved in looking at the problem
so
space.
There was a plan to put the military in to spring them out.
There's always a plan when Brits are kidnapped overseas. If we have to take positive action to secure their safe release, we need to know where the stronghold is. I think through the use of our assets, we were able to identify where the stronghold was, but we were also able to identify that it was heavily fortified and there were at least 50 heavily armed Mujahideen there guarding the three guys who'd been kidnapped. So it would have been a very, very nasty extraction if it had gone to that. But the bottom line was our High Commissioner did an absolutely magnificent job to negotiate at all the high levels and use these personal contacts to secure their safe release. And after a couple of weeks, we did get them out. And they were pretty shattered after 2 weeks, I have to say, as were their families. People often forget it's their families sitting in the background who are feeling the pain as well. For us, it was a huge learning lesson just about monitoring where our liaison officers are at every stage, whether overseas, making sure, you know, they were checking in with London as well about where they're going. Afghanistan was off limits to us at that time, so it was a difficult situation, but we were very, very pleased that we were able to secure the safe release of all three guys.
What do you think the Mujahideen had in mind as a ransom? Well, I mean, they obviously they took them for a reason. It was a negotiating tool for somebody else?
I'm sure it was. I think if you put it in context, it's a Wild West out there. I think 200 people had been killed in that area in the last few months. The same people had attacked some Americans over there, some American intelligence people recently. So this was not a good situation, but I think UK Limited showed, working with our German and Dutch colleagues, you know, just how well we can plan for these things and how well we can execute that plan. This incident also led to a major change in our training, Graham, didn't it?
Very much so. Phil recognised that the training that we'd had prior to us going was good, but it was very basic. And what you now had for the first time ever was two DLOs, previous DLOs, now back in London at the centre as part of the management structure overseeing the DLOs overseas. It then meant you were bringing first-hand knowledge of the situation and being at the centre and able to then think, what do we need to get right? So Phil went ahead and started to reorganise the training, which I then, when Phil moved on, I took over from and built up on that. And we went from a 1 week very basic course to a month. And this then included all the elements that we'd learned where the pitfalls were. And one of the things that we did was how to react if you found yourself in a situation like Jack.
So you'd actually have training, and if you've been kidnapped, you would put people in those environments where, you know, you actually mock up a kidnap and what it might be.
Yeah, this is nothing too new to us as professional investigators because, you know, in later lives, we were responsible for kidnap and extortion requests in the UK. But when there's a Brit kidnapped abroad, our intelligence services take the lead on that, working closely with Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office and other people. So we wanted to gear our training to make absolutely sure the guys and girls were prepared for the worst possible scenario.
And I believe, Graham, it led to an amusing incident at an investigation division dinner.
On his return back, when he had to submit his expenses claim in, the decision was made that he wouldn't get subsistence. He would go on to what we term actuals, which means he got what he got in the cave and he didn't get any other money. Of course, this just, it was light-hearted, but in a good way because it just, you know, diffuses situation and that.
So you're going to just charge for a bowl of gruel and some water.
That was it. But I think the other good thing is the two things that came out of this, the main thing was, don't get yourself in that bloody situation in the first place. So that became part of the training. And it was all about the DLO. When you're overseas, make sure somebody knows where you are at all times. Your desk officer, he's your lifeblood. Make sure he knows what you're doing. And before you do anything, just clear it with them. The other thing that we also did was we started to do some basic training for spouses, for the partners of the people who were going abroad, because I think, as Phil had previously seen, we had occasions where people went home and said, pack your bags, we're off to India tomorrow. But we realised that wasn't, you know, we needed to become more professional. So you get the prospective candidates coming along with their spouses and giving a feel for what a post overseas was like.
And I think the other thing for the listener, Linz, is that if you're a Brit or any national kidnapped in the UK, we will throw the kitchen sink at identifying the stronghold where you are and help secure your safe release. This is nothing about catching and convicting the kidnappers. This is securing your safe release. And if you're a Brit kidnapped abroad, we'll do the same thing. The UK has the best record in the world at securing the safe release of people kidnapped. We have over 500 people a year kidnapped in the UK, and we generally...
500 a year?
Over 500 a year. A lot of them, of course, are criminals on criminals.
Many of these never get in the press.
No, and many of them are drug traffickers or serious criminals kidnapping their rivals or people who they think they've stolen from them, etc. But we throw the same amount of resource at those cases as we do for a person who's kidnapped off the street for other reasons.
Like Phil and Graham, Dave Cater worked as a drug liaison officer deployed to both Afghanistan and Nigeria, two very dangerous postings. Dave has a really interesting backstory. He started in the parachute regiment, worked in industry as an engineer, came back into the National Crime Agency, but also was a DLO in Africa. We've looked at the problem of drugs coming from the Caribbean through from South America, but how important to the drug trade was Africa? Dave, I think, has probably the most complex and interesting CV I've seen so far, starting with the parachute regiment, going into industry as an engineer, working with the National Crime Agency, serious organised crime agency as well, but also becoming a drug liaison officer and also managing DLOs abroad, and especially in Africa. You left school at 16, I believe, and then you found yourself in as a reservist in the parachute regiment. Tell us about that.
Yes, I left at 16. Minimal qualifications, started a fairly traditional, in the old-fashioned sense, apprenticeship, learning fabrication skills. In parallel to that, I was a reservist in what was the Territorial Army Parachute Regiment, which I did for three years or so before eventually transferring to the Intelligence Corps, where I spent most of my time as a military reservist. It's the British Army's intelligence arm. So they basically were formed in 1940, the modern corps, and they provide the intelligence support to commanders in the field. So ranging from looking at what the enemy's intentions are, our own commanders can, you know, influence the way they plan what they're doing.
Some of those sources would be human sources.
Can be human
informants.
Sources.
Others, yep, would be interception, as you call it, which is, what is interception?
Interception is the process of intercepting communication. So the formal title is interception of communications. In the modern world now is typically telephone interception, but it can include postal interception. And in a more military context, it's more about radio traffic and capturing. But that is more typically done in the British military by the signals regiments. But with the intelligence corps would work closely with them to help analyse what it is that's being collected.
I was interested to see it that ministers have signed off on ICOR being integrated into the new military intelligence service, which is going to be the fourth arm of the intelligence agencies in the UK, supporting GCHQ, the government's communications headquarters, secret intelligence service and our security service. So that's quite topical at the moment.
And you'd support that, would you?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, military intelligence is absolutely vital going forward. And you've only got to look at one area, cyber attack, and what Russians and other hostile nations are doing against the UK and others around the world to see that in a battlefield context, how important digital communications are, either in an offensive way or in a defensive way. So having a military intelligence services that pulls together the disparate feds in a collaborative way of our military intelligence seems to me to be absolutely a sensible thing to do.
In a previous episode, Phil and Graham were discussing the whole business of interception, and the UK is one of the few places where you cannot use the information that you gather, whereas in America you can use intercept. Do you still think, do you think that's odd, or do you think our system is better?
I like our system. I think it works. The reason it works is because what it's done is it's given us, within our investigations, the discipline of building a case properly. We don't just rely on that one crunchy little piece of telephone conversation that might mean, yep, you've been arrested, you know, fine, and then we stop there. The way that the UK uses it means that our investigation teams have to build a case around it, which means that case has to be solid legally to get through the court process. And also the other point is, it doesn't give away too many of our techniques because the same discipline applies to some of the other sensitive things we do with collecting intelligence.
And that's absolutely vital in not telling criminal organisations, terrorists, insurgents and spies that we're unable to exploit certain technology, because unsurprisingly, they would then use that technology against us. So we're very confident that ministers will continue to support intercept as intelligence and not go down the line as intercept as evidence. We've done very well over the last few years in managing this. I don't see any reason why we can't go forward just as successfully.
But it's an arms race between you and the criminal, isn't it? Because they're always looking to use technology themselves, and you've got to technically, and through using intelligence, keep up with that and beat it.
Yeah, and you've seen the recent news stories over the last few months about the EncroChat system. That was a collaboration between Dutch, French, British, American.
And that was basically getting a large amount of information from encrypted messages between drug dealers and organised criminals.
The criminal group set up a server and they were marketing it as a secure system of communications with dedicated handsets that look just like ordinary mobile phones, and they pass through their server, and effectively they were undetectable.
So you go from NSIS, you know, then in the newly organised, serious organised crime agency, and then you ended up working with Phil, or for Phil.
Yeah, so Phil was working with established a team with providing support to the liaison officer network around the world. And very shortly after that, I went off to Afghanistan to tackle primarily the heroin trafficking back to the UK and Europe.
Pretty dangerous place when you went to Afghanistan. I mean, it's always been a dangerous place. But do you remember how you felt when they said, do you fancy going and living in Kabul?
Yeah, well, I volunteered and applied for the job, so I was obviously quite happy to go.
You couldn't take a partner, could you, in those days?
No partners, families or anything like that. It was what's known as an unaccompanied posting.
Because it was too dangerous.
Yeah, but we lived in very restricted conditions, you know, in compounds and so on. We had security, protection, armoured vehicles and so on to move around. But we were well prepared before that with lots of training in terms of operating in those kind of environments.
But your role was not, you're not dealing with the Taliban, you're dealing with the drug trade coming through Afghanistan.
That's right.
Being generated from Afghanistan.
Originating from Afghanistan. So, yeah, we worked with the drugs police there and helped them improve their capabilities in investigating all drugs-related crime. There's a whole range of operations, I have to say, from really quite small, you know, a few kilos of opium, fairly raw opium found in the boot of a car, on a very simple bit of informant information, to some really quite major labs where huge kilos and kilos, tons of heroin were being produced.
What was the route in those days from the labs through Afghanistan and to Europe?
A lot was passing through Iran, back westwards, effectively, back through Turkey and elsewhere through the Balkans, back towards the Netherlands. And a lot of it, especially at the very basic level from Afghanistan, was being taken by donkey and mule train across the border. Some was being processed and taken across in vehicles aided by corruption, with officials turning a blind eye or sometimes even being involved, you know.
What was daily life like? I mean, where did you live? I mean, how dangerous did it feel while you were working there?
So it was a restricted lifestyle. We lived in a number of compounds sort of joined together. So you didn't get a lot of time on your own. You know, you couldn't just go for a walk around the block just to get away from everyone. There were places you could go and socialise, restaurants and so on, but they were strictly managed and controlled about where you could go and when you could go.
It must feel a bit claustrophobic at
times. Most definitely. And, you know, we all had good days and bad days. Some people, coped with it better than others.
Were there occasions where you felt yourself in personal danger?
I mean, it wasn't unusual for rocket attacks and so on to be fired into Kabul in the centre and towards the area of, you know, the diplomatic community. I've been reasonably close to one or two big bombs that have gone off, that's for sure. The sound of gunfire and so on was pretty common.
But a daily occurrence.
In the evenings, yeah, you'd hear incidents. But it wasn't always clear, you know, the police, there were, you know, lots of army patrols, whether that be sort of coalition ISAF forces or the local forces, plus the police, all armed. Lots of Afghans have got weapons, you know. It's just a cultural, it's a way of life. I do recall one evening where we had an earthquake. And I remember the next day chatting with one of my colleagues in Dubai. He said to me, how are you doing? How's life in Kabul? Oh, yeah, it's okay, you know. It's been terrible here. I said, we've had this really, really heavy rains. When I got up this morning, my swimmer pool had overflowed and flooded the kitchen. And I thought, yeah, well, what did I do last night? I was sheltering from an earthquake, and then 2 hours later, I was sheltering in the basement.
You said you didn't have access to an outdoor swimming pool.
From a rocket attack.
I think it's worth remembering, Linz, when Dave was first deployed to Afghanistan, we'd never deployed any police or law enforcement officers there before. This was the biggest heroin-producing country in the world. It grew huge amounts of poppy plants. It produced tons and tons of opium, and it produced tons and tons of heroin. It was absolutely fantastic time for us because we were at source, in source, gathering the intelligence on drug trafficking groups seeking to exploit the UK and European market. And we did such a really good job down there. Managing and mitigating risk was a constant battle down there, and they did a really good job in upskilling the local agencies, training the local agencies, increasing their professionalism, increasing their capability, and we benefited directly from that. But it was a really tough posting. In my personal view, the toughest posting in the world, and they did a fantastic job there for UK Limited, working alongside our intelligence agencies, working alongside our special forces, and working alongside the Afghan special forces that assisted us with attacking heroin labs all over the country. Because, as we've mentioned in a previous episode, a lot of the ground in Afghanistan was not controlled by the government. And unsurprisingly, this is where they grew opium. And this is where they had heroin labs. Some of these heroin labs were up in the mountains at 10,000 feet. You know, we burst in there, destroyed the lab, and then we burst out. And we tried not to have any casualties, because nobody wants to write to an officer's wife or partner to say that they've been killed in Afghanistan. I can tell you, on my first trip to Afghanistan, I was flying from Dubai to Kabul, and for the last sort of 20 minutes of the journey to avoid anti-aircraft missiles. The plane drops 5,000 feet out of the air in a few seconds. Well, the guys and girls with me knew this because they'd been before. I didn't know this.
You thought you were crashing?
I thought I was crashing. I thought we'd been hit by a missile and we were flying downwards very, very quickly and my heart was in my mouth. My wife says I was probably screaming at the time. And I looked up to see the boys and girls laughing. And then I realised they were taking the piss out of me, which wasn't unusual. It was one of their ways of actually managing the stress of these sort of things. But they were going there regularly. Dave was living there for two and a half years. You know, that shows you a calibre of these people who are out there doing this.
So, Dave, eventually you come back to London after your second spell in what Phil's described as probably the most dangerous posting on Earth. You then take a nice soft posting because you go to Nigeria. You work in Lagos and Abuja. Tell us how you ended up with that job.
Foolishly, I applied for it.
like an edge of danger, don't
you? I think for me the appeal, similar to the Afghanistan role, is something new. New project, setting up from scratch, getting that opportunity to do that. You know, picking people, recruiting them, choosing them, training them, putting them together as a team, getting them to develop and bring them forward. That, to me, is a motivator.
Set the scene for our listeners. I mean, these are edgy, dangerous places, aren't they? Lagos and Abuja.
Abuja, actually, when you go, it feels quite calm. Lagos is a different matter entirely, a big, vibrant, mad city. It feels mad, but it can feel quite intimidating when you first step out of the airport because immediately you're swamped by individuals who either want to help you, want to sell you something, you know, want to carry your bag or whatever. And if you're uncomfortable in that situation, then you might easily sort of decide, I'm going to get back on the plane and go home again. The big threat there is kidnap of foreigners, especially.
So you would have been target yourself?
Yeah, most definitely. But I have to say, you know, a huge amount of Nigerians are kidnapped all the time by kidnap gangs. It's still a huge problem.
Would you be armed in a place like
that? No, that's just the arrangement that the local police provide the armed protection. So you'd have access to Nigerian police who would be armed as your protection.
And before we talk about what you were doing individually, we've looked at, you know, the South American connection, the Caribbean, moving drugs through to Europe and so on. Where did Africa, where did Nigeria fit into the world, the global drug trade when you first went there? What was its importance?
The whole of West Africa was considered basically a transit point for cocaine coming from South America. So the small light aircraft were being flown across the Atlantic to land in West Africa. And that whole process end to end was still being managed by South Americans. But other West Africans started to realise, well, we can get involved with this ourselves and manage it ourselves and, you know, become part of the trade and make our own money.
So they would make links with the cartels and say, well, we'll deal with the stuff when it arrives.
Yep.
For at a price.
Which means that you ended up with a situation, certainly 2013, when I was there getting involved with this new project, a very large Nigerian community in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And even though Brazil is not a cocaine producing country, it is a big dispatch point, effectively.
How much was coming over?
Tons. And in different sources. Sometimes it was coming in containers, large multi-hundred kilos in containers on ships. Other times it was coming by couriers who were carrying, you know, much smaller quantities, either in their sort of personal baggage or through sort of swallowing pellets. And an experienced swallower can probably carry 1.5 kilos.
1.5 kilos?
Internally, yeah. Yeah. I think the largest I ever saw was one guy was arrested with 3.2 kilos that he'd ingested.
As Dave describes, that whole area of what we call collectively stuffers and swallowers has been around for a long time. But, you know, as we said before, in previous episodes, you know, if you're a young person thinking of smuggling drugs, Can you imagine what it's like when one of these things bursts inside you internally? Now, you've got about a 95% chance of dying fairly quickly in a most unpleasant way.
And you saw this too, Dave, as well.
Yeah, so we had a case of a trafficker who pellets burst inside them during a flight. He was taken ill. He obviously realised what the problem was. And at that point, two or three other couriers who were on the flight with him all declared themselves because they were concerned. They'd obviously got them from the same source. Unfortunately, that guy died and the others were arrested when it touched down.
In an earlier episode, we were talking about Operation Journey and Jezebel and the traffickers in South America moving multi-tons of cocaine over the pond in motherships offloaded to daughter vessels into the coast of Spain, usually Galicia, and that spread a little bit. But after a while, of course, when we put the focus of our intelligence gathering efforts on that, they moved. They moved to Africa, the West Gulf of Africa. And there, then you've got the first stages of Dave saying, you know, the drug trafficking organisations in Africa saying, oh, we can play this game. We can get involved in this. They've got fantastic communication systems down there, transport hubs. So, the traffickers, the South American traffickers, and particularly the African traffickers, were then into the business of buying businesses, buying transport businesses, buying hotels, investing their money, as well as using them to provide transport for drugs onwards into Europe or where else. And, you know, Dave was at the heart of that again.
Some of those drugs are coming into West Africa, to Nigeria, to be used and sold locally. But some of the drugs coming in are to be shipped onwards to Europe, I assume.
The bulk of it was being moved to elsewhere around the world. From West Africa, primarily Europe, and a good amount, I think, to the UK. But we also saw drugs going to Australia, going to even to the US.
When you first got there, you've got to make relations with the people in law enforcement in Nigeria. How well did he get on with the people towards the top of the law enforcement agencies you needed to deal with? Do you get some help from them?
Yeah, well, very much, yeah. I mean, for a start, we needed, you know, their help and their permission to work with their people. In fact, quite often they came to us and said, you know, can you help us improve what we're doing? And we'd often, in many cases, certainly in Nigeria, we had, you know, a long-established relationship with some of those main law enforcement agencies where we were already sharing intelligence, doing shared cases and so on, in both directions.
Overall, it was a place you enjoyed living and working, looking back.
I did, very much so, yeah. The work was really interesting.
And I think I'm right in saying, Dave, that one of the agencies there actually has their headquarters named after you.
I didn't know about this, and this was when I went back for my second tour working in West Africa, and this time I went back in a different role as the regional manager. And I was invited to the opening ceremony of this new building, this new complex, by the chairman of the agency. And I was very surprised when I got there to see the name plaque on the wall with my name on it.
So, and Crater House is there to this day.
It's there. It's there now.
But Dave, thank you very much for sharing some extraordinary stories with us from your own career and the insights in Africa and the drug trade as well. Like Phil and Dave and Graham, Steve Coates spent years on the front line of the global drugs trade. He left school early, but in the 70s, enthusiasm, a positive attitude, curiosity, and the ability to learn on the job got him a post with UK Customs and Excise. Later in his career, he developed a lifelong fascination with Turkey, its culture, and the local smugglers illegally supplying the UK's heroin market. Steve, welcome to Narco Warriors. Can we go right back to the beginning? We want to talk about the big heroin connection and your involvement in stopping the heroin trade later on. What was life like in the investigation division in those days when you first would have remembered Graham and the culture there?
The culture was hardworking, quite a bit of drinking, superb banter, great camaraderie. It was for a young man and women were coming in. It was a terrific place to to work. Very varied. We were divided into specific crime areas. So, for example, I was very much drugs until I went off to do strategic exports, which is a very, very interesting part of my career.
Were there any particular operations or individuals that you managed to put away that you're still proud of as you look back?
Yeah, I'm famous there amongst my colleagues for work on a particular operation called Operation Fan, which was, they'll laugh in a minute, and anyone listening to this who knows me will laugh, which was a heroin operation, but it was against Iranian nationals that had left Iran in 1979, and they were part of a pro-Shah group, and some of them were linked to the infamous Iranian secret police called SAVAK. One in particular I won't name.
And SAVAK worked for the Shah during that regime.
Absolutely, yep. Absolutely. The big problem was that we started with a clean sheet on these Iranians. We didn't have a wide intelligence base, but we did have very good intelligence support, but we hadn't got into that community. We were focused on Asian gangs, Turkish gangs to a certain extent. So it took us a long, long while to get into it, to understand the dynamics. And we eventually managed to arrest the group with 25 kilos of heroin, I think it was, which came in a car through Dover. But the funny thing was that the car broke down in northern France and had to be brought into the UK on a low loader. And that's one of the things that's great about investigation work. You have to roll with a punch and, you know, our colleagues, we're used to, you know, no plan withstands first contact with the main body of the enemy.
So the car is in northern France, but it breaks down. You've got it under surveillance, I assume.
Yeah.
And then it's on a low loader. What sort of problems does that pose? What did you do next?
Well, in the first instance, it makes it easier to follow.
Because it's slow.
So,
Graham and Philip made clear quite a lot of the operations where you didn't want to nick it then because you get the guy in the car, but you want to understand where it's come from.
Yeah.
Who's got it now, but where it's going to and how it's going to be distributed.
But yeah. But through intelligence, we knew roughly who was dealing with it. The heroin was in the car. And from my perspective, I was just providing intelligence to the officers on the ground.
Was that being financed by the secret police in Iran then?
No,
this particular?
No. But they still had extensive contact with Iran. And we knew that they were involved with a group in Quetta in Pakistan who were shipping very large quantities of heroin across from Afghanistan and then into Western Europe. And this was then, this method went on to be replicated right the way through the 90s. So they bring a bulk load into Western Europe and then break it down into smaller quantities for different customers. It's no different to any other form of commerce. It's just some of the logistics things are slightly different. Yeah.
And did this particular team, were they convicted? Did they go to prison?
Yeah, they were convicted, yeah.
They all went down. Most of you who joined didn't have degrees, but it was obviously a time when if you had the right attitude, enthusiasm and curiosity, you'd be taken on and trained, and you've all had amazing careers. Would that be possible today, do you think?
I'm not sure it would be today. We all need a degree of luck, don't we? I had some luck. I had some fantastic people around me. I had some people that identified that I was, strangely, might have been reasonably good at or half good at something.
So later on, you're still in London, but then you become the assistant director of heroin operations. And moving forward a bit in 2002, tell us how you got that job and what it meant. What were you doing?
I was quite a successful senior investigation officer, leading a heroin target team with a number of other great colleagues and a fantastic group of men and women. Fantastic. We had lots of success. And after 4 years, I was plucked from that role and sent to be the chief investigation officer's bag carrier or staff officer, a role which I performed for about 9 months.
This is Paul Evans.
This is Paul Evans. And Paul, very, very interesting man, superbly intelligent, the best public speaker I've ever heard, difficult to work for, challenging. Anyway, I was in that role as his bag carrier, and one day he was struggling with a particular appointment, which was who ran the investigation service for customs in Glasgow. And he was sat there with his head in his hands and he couldn't work out who was going to take this role. And he said to me, I said, what's the problem? He said, need somebody to go to Glasgow. So I said, I know somebody will go to Glasgow. And he said, if he goes to Glasgow, you can have his job.
So you're at the senior seat.
So then I ran the branch that I'd left 9 months before. I had some fantastic officers working for me, did some fantastic jobs, seized a lot of heroin. But now we were right in amongst the Turks, Turkish organised crime, as we had been when I was an operational commander on one of the target teams. And Turkish heroin, as everyone knows, is my sort of favourite subject.
Now your career really concentrates on heroin or importation, but particularly from Turkey. So can you just give the listeners an idea of what was happening?
Almost all the heroin on the streets of the UK at that time, in the 90s and the early 2000s, was Afghan heroin. Usually it would be brought in bulk by a truck. Turkish groups particularly like trucks, but the Kurds were involved, and the very, very big seizures were Kurdish organised. The largest heroin seizure at that time was 1997, just before I joined the team. It was done by Chris Harrison, Malcolm Bragg and his colleagues. That was Operation Absorb, and that was 404 kilos.
So you had this very big
So
success.
These large consignments were coming in, and they would go typically to the Netherlands, but not exclusively, sometimes Belgium, sometimes France, sometimes somewhere in Eastern Europe.
Are they coming overland in lorries?
And what that's all in lorry, the big movements, and then that would be put into a stash somewhere, broken down into smaller consignments. Now, what we were doing in the late 90s and early 2000s is we had very good intelligence support, and we would very often work on a gang that were receiving the heroin. But we didn't know how it was coming over because they operate on a cell-like structure. And they had different ways of doing it. Sometimes they would recruit drivers to bring across, might be a smaller quantity, 10, 15, 20, 30 kilos in a car, something like that. But typically, this was the way, not exclusively, there were still suitcase seizures at Heathrow, but this was these were the big quantities. And they would come in, and we would be waiting on the people who were the recipients. We didn't know how it was coming over, but we waited. And then when we had sufficient intelligence and we saw a vehicle or something like that and we were out on surveillance, then we would hit them. Sometimes they changed MO. There were different groups and they would be operating, let's say, from the Netherlands, and they would have a representative of the group who would travel to the UK, usually by air, hire a car. And his job was to connect a vehicle with heroin in it, could be a lorry, with the recipients. So even the recipients wouldn't know, the Turks waiting, usually in London, but not exclusively, how it was coming in. They wouldn't need to know. And the connection was made with the person that came over from the continent. Yeah, and very often they would be in the UK 12, 24, 36 hours, depending on how long it took to put the two together. We would wait for the heroin to be removed from the vehicle, if we saw bags or holdalls, and then we would knock it.
And was there a Mr. Big in London at the time organising this?
Right. I would say no. We identified five high-harm groups. A lot of the Turks that we worked on, they kept themselves off the law enforcement radar. They didn't drive around in a big luxury limo. It wasn't like the Sopranos.
Were there violent groups at
times? There were violent groups. There's a famous group in London called the Bombachillas and the Tottenham Boys who are still at it. But that tended to be the lower level criminality. We were very much focused from a customs and excise perspective. We're focused on the importation and the offences related to that. We obviously work with the police in terms of some of the violent stuff. Generally speaking, lots of them were under the radar. Some of them had criminal records. I mean, I'm talking generally. They liked, you know, they were normal. They packed up on one occasion, the criminal group we were working on, because it was the World Cup. And they went to the World Cup and we saw them standing behind a goal in a particular match.
Can you talk about how you were gathering this intelligence?
Yeah, it's no secret that we were actively intercepting communications, and that became more important as time progressed, together with data, communications data analysis. We had informants.
Did you run informants yourself with the team?
No. There was a separation between the teams that did that, undercover work and informants. I did subsequently, in my later career, have the undercover and informant capabilities in my command. But my main area of expertise was working on intercept work.
Going back to this particular time in your career, that heroin importation, how much of it do you think, looking back, you managed to shut down?
The analysts did some work. And for the first time ever, I'm talking now probably somewhere in the region of 2008, 2009, they came up with a figure of between 18 to 23 tonnes of heroin per annum to feed the UK user population. We don't like the word addict from a law enforcement perspective. But some people are perfectly able to function even though they're taking heroin. So 18 to 23 tonnes.
Do you both remember in those days this whole business of legalisation? There's always been a debate about legalisation of cannabis. If you both look back now, do you think there was an argument at the time to legalise cannabis? It's not much different from tobacco and alcohol. Let's concentrate on the heroin and the cocaine.
I've got a personal view. I've seen people who are habitual users of cannabis and they're fucked up. And I wouldn't advocate legalizing it. If you did legalize it, like you've got tobacco now, the government would put a tax on it. And the next thing is you would have a black market in it. And it just wouldn't work. I'm not saying it's a pathway to using harder drugs, but as I say, I've seen people who have been habitual users and they have got a real mental and physical health problems.
Would you agree, Steve?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think rather than use Graham's vernacular, I would say there's evidence that it does lead to long-term psychosis. But he summed it up so much better than I did.
Coming up next time on Narco Warriors... He drove a red Rolls-Royce, he wore fashionable clothes. Gigi Bakir lived the high life, and it was all funded by drug smuggling. But how did Gigi avoid jail time for murder? And how did he become a supergrass? Taking down the Turkish connection, these are the Narco Warriors. Join us again soon.